Welcome to the One Mind Dogs From the Dog's Perspective podcast. I'm your host, Noora Keskivari, and on this show, we explore personal dog journeys and uncover how we can become the best possible dog owners. From the dog's perspective, of course. I'm super passionate about understanding the dog's perspective and with that, helping others to have a happy and balanced life with their dogs. It's always very inspirational to hear it from others, their journey with their dogs and learning more about the dog's perspective. Today, our guest is Beth McLeod from the United States of America. Beth is a very experienced dog trainer and dog enthusiast, and she is passionate about educating people about how dogs really are and how we can develop a better relationship with them. She also says that she loves to fix things at her house, so I would just welcome her to our house as well at any time. So obviously, I can't wait to hear more about her experiences and dog journey. So welcome to the podcast, Beth.
Thanks, Noora. Thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to have this conversation.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I think it'll be fun. I actually am the director of training and behavior for a humane society right outside of Boston. I have been training dogs professionally since the late 90s. And I was really fortunate enough to fall in with some great mentors at that point that kind of led me in a different direction from how I had previously trained just my own dogs, you know, and that's kind of how I got into things professionally.
Right. It's so interesting, your story. And I have a couple of questions about that later. So we will definitely hear about your work as well. Let's deep dive into your personal dog journey. So if you can remember your childhood or the first time that you were really meeting dogs and thinking of, hey, one day I will also have my own dog. So can you share us what you remember from that time?
Yeah, I have almost always, my entire life, had a dog present in my life. I do remember the first dog that I was aware of, which was a beautiful rough-coated collie, who we named Twiggy because it was the 60s. And she was left at the dump. Someone had just, you know, that was in the days when we didn't have recycling centers or anything. And somebody had just brought her to the dump, tied her up and left her there. And so my grandfather found her, brought her to my mother, and then she was ours, you know, forever after. And it kind of opened up a whole journey. And I think I was five at the time, rescuing dogs. I actually now at just turned 60, have my first purebred from a fantastic breeder dog. My whole entire life has always been rescue, not for any other reason than that. That's the path I took. I remember one of the dogs that I had, I was in college and for some reason went to the local humane society. I think I was actually going to go volunteer, but instead I walked out with this beautiful Irish setter and ended up giving up my housing for an entire year because you couldn't have a dog in the dorms. And I was like, well, there's a no-brainer. I'd rather have the dog than the dorm, right? So that really has always been my, you know, kind of feeling about dogs complete us, or not all of us, but certainly, you know, some of us. You can't really imagine not having a dog in your life. And there has only been one period of time that I haven't had a dog. And that was when I moved to California. I was with my husband and I moved out with one daughter, was pregnant with a second, and then ended up having a third while I was out there. It was a very different space. I was used to being from New England where we had like big pieces of property. And so when I went out there was these tiny little, you know, like everybody had these tiny little fence yards. It was very different for me. So it was the only time I didn't have dogs. And it actually worked out well. You know, having dogs with young children, a lot of my clients are in that position where they have challenges because they have very young children, or they have a dog who's, and then they've just had a baby and they haven't exposed the dog to any of those small crawling prey that, you know, that dogs see babies as. So it was a nice little respite for me to kind of get my kids to that age five-ish where I felt like, okay, now we can move forward. And then I was right back into, you know, generally I have three dogs at a time. I have had four. Three seems like a nice number for me. You know, it seems like I can managed that pretty easily. Along the way, I kind of morphed into Loving Goldens is my breed, although I currently have a 16-year-old Pekingese whose name is Buddy. He's pretty much an Ottoman with legs at this point, but we love him to death. He was one of my daughter's acquisitions. They wanted small, white, fluffy dogs. That has never been where I looked, but they wanted them. And so we got one. And of course, he wanted to play with the big dogs. And I knew he was going to get broken. So we got another. And we still have one of them years after the girls have all left. So dogs have just always been a part of my life.
Oh, wow. That's a story. And I think it's really a special story with the first dog of yours, this collie that you found. So it would be lovely to even hear more about that and see more pictures. But I don't know, do you have any videos or anything? Or
I don't have anything? Video. I my dad recently passed away and we were going through some pictures and I did find a picture of that collie. So I'll see if I can dig it out. And, you know, I think I was sitting there in my little Sunday coat, you know, just having gone to church or something, you know, with me and the collie. So I'll see if I can dig that out and send it along.
Well, that would be a lovely thing. Yeah, very interesting. Well, if you put it short, it's obvious that dogs are a big part of your life and your lifestyle. But what's there particularly in dogs that inspires and motivates and keeps you going with them?
I think having, you know, I was really lucky to get pointed in a certain direction. And two books fell into my lap early on. One was Karen Pryor's Don't Shoot the Dog. And the other one was actually Jean Donaldson's Culture Clash. And both of those dogs really caused me to, it was like the scales fell away. Like what I thought a dog was, I mean, my dogs were always well-loved, cared for, everything else. But what I really thought a dog was became something totally different. You know, when I really started to realize like, this isn't just a dog. This is a sentient being with thoughts and feelings and emotions. And of course they respond in X way because this is who they are. And of course we're expecting too much for them. They're a nonverbal species, right? So I just saw that I could maybe help change people's perspectives on what really is a dog. No, it's not something that just came from FAO Schwartz. It's not a thing. It's a being, right? And so I, you know, most of the work that I do is with behavior work. I'm a behavior consultant and again, the training and behavior director. A lot of the stuff that I do is hard. People are struggling, right? They don't come to me with all the happy stuff. Like, oh, I want to teach my dog to whatever. You know, they come because they have challenges and it gets sometimes overwhelming, but just when you see somebody understand that, oh, there is a way I can communicate, even though we don't speak the same language, right? That when you see the eyes open, it's such a rewarding process. So I think that's what keeps me motivated. It keeps me excited. It keeps me learning. We're so lucky, you know, to have COVID, as horrible as it was, it did us a service. We got access to materials and to people that never would we ever have had that access because everybody was, you know, you'd go to a seminar, be in person, you'd fly across the country and spend 3 days there. But now there's not a half a day that goes by without a seminar dropping into my email box or, you know, somebody sharing a new scientific paper. It's just really amazing the information that we can have to help us on that journey to understanding how do we understand this other being and help them live their best life with us. They didn't pick, we picked. So it's our responsibility. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. I can totally relate to that. And I totally agree. And that's something that motivates me as well. So that's why we are having this podcast, for example.
Yes.
So it's just so inspiring to inspire others. So that's the
thing. It really is.
The One Mind Dogs method is all about the dog's point of view, and everything we teach is about seeing the world from the dog's perspective and having fun together. I believe that having fun together is a critical point in this, that also that the dog is having fun, not only the people. And in this podcast, we want to share real life stories about how learning more about the dog's perspective has actually impacted the life with dogs. Beth, you have joined One Mind Dogs community about 10 years ago. Can you share us a little bit of like, how did you get started with One Mind Dogs?
I actually, a friend of mine who's also a trainer said, oh, you know, we have the same mindset about this is how we should look at dogs. This is how we want to interact with dogs, right? And she's like, you have to check out this thing. It's One Mind Dogs. It's like somewhere over in, you know, the Netherlands, but we can get online and look at these videos. And so we did. And the whole thing just resonated for me. I haven't competed really. I have a little bit dabbled in it, but I just, you know, I had three girls and all these things were going on. And so again, this is now I have my first dog and I have been much more serious about training with her, not my first dog, but my first competition dog. Right. And so we're kind of headed in that direction, but I have had so much joy, like just wanting to do something with one of my dogs. It's a little different, and being able to go into the One Mind library and say, oh, let's work on this. And every once in a while, as much as I feel like I am a good trainer and I do have good foundations, somebody will say something and it's so basic, it's so foundation, but I'll go, oh yeah, I didn't think of that. Or, oh, wow, that really affected how the dog connects with me. And it'd be something little, like your eyes should be over here instead of over here, right? It's not like I'm looking at all super advanced stuff. It's stuff that any new dog owner could look at and really see how truly impacts our connection with our dogs, you know, just these basic foundational things. And I was lucky because I brought my dog home 2 weeks before the world shut down for COVID, which was right about the time you guys came out with the puppy program. So I had this lovely, you know, 50-page training plan that I had, you know, been working on for a year from when I brought my puppy home, and then everything changed. And so it was so great to have that as a resource as well. Like, okay, I can't take her here, there, and everywhere and have people put all their germy hands on her because we don't know what's happening, but I can do all these great things. And so I've, you know, it's nice. It's a great resource for me, for the shelter, to be able to send people to that program, right? Just as an aside from the agility side of it, because the thing, you know, and I thought about this a lot as you had sent me those questions. I think the thing that is most important for me is making sure that dogs feel safe, and knowing how One Mind approaches those interactions, I feel like I can send anybody and always know whoever I send is going to be safe. No one is going to ask a dog to do something that I feel might make that dog uncomfortable. Does that make sense?
Indeed. Yeah, very well said and described. You already described quite a bit of your experience on how your whole perspective changed a while ago, like related to dogs and dog training. Is there something like concrete that our listeners can get it immediately, like, that was kind of the eye-opener for you once you started to learn more about the dog's perspective?
Not so much the dog's perspective, because I think once you kind of see that, wait a minute, this is not a vacuum. This is not, you know, a car. This is an actual sentient being. And I think people, they do see that. They see that, wait a minute, now we're having a conversation with my dog versus a me telling. You do this because I said, you do that because I said. You get into that conversation with your dog and you start looking at, you know, where does my dog seem happiest? How can I set my dog up for success? How can I not put undue pressure on my dog, right? So that the dog begins, you just see the dogs begin to really flourish, you know? But I think one, as an aside, like for me, I was always worried about getting into agility because people are serious. I mean, you go to a trial, is, you know, it's not like a keg party, right? And so the one thing that I saw from One Mind right away is how much fun both the dog and the handler were having. And again, like you said, I've been doing this for 10 years. So I knew when I picked up my puppy a couple of years ago, you know, this is a breeder who most people compete who have her puppies. But I was very clear that it's not going to be me who's going to determine what we do. I'll put it out there for Frankie, who's my puppy, my little girl, and let her choose. If she doesn't, you know, if she ended up not loving agility, I would be doing tracking or something. But I think that's part of what One Mind shows, is that this is what you want to see. You want to see this level of joy, this level of connection, this level of enthusiasm to ensure that you're on the right path with your dog.
Exactly. That's so interesting. You put it in so nicely in wording. So yeah, I could listen to this for hours. So let's continue.
Okay.
I typically ask about any dog training hurdles or struggles people have had, but as you are a professional with the behavior stuff, and you have seen like hundreds of clients with challenges, can you mention like one of those challenges that is really typical and some simple first step that people have taken and then which leads eventually to success?
I think, as opposed to like a particular behavior, I think what we want to help people understand is that when you look at any behavior that's happening, that's let's say an unwelcome behavior, right? If we can find a way to communicate with the dog, the key is give the dog the information that they need to be successful. I am one of those trainers who tries really hard not to say no to my dog. And it's not because, I mean, just like with my kids, there are boundaries, there are things we can do, things we can't do, things that are, you know, desirable, things that are undesirable. It's not that. It's that I look at no as such a useless piece of information. It doesn't mean I don't say it, because I'm a human and I am verbal and I say it to my husband and my kids and my friends. No, whatever. But when I say that word, no, to my dogs, it's a red flag for me to look and see, oh, wait a minute, what is it you want in this situation? And then train that thing, whatever it is. You know, if I have a dog that jumps up, what do I want? Well, there's 40 things I could train. I could train my dog to keep their feet on the floor, to sit, to go get a toy, you know, and on and on and on. But I think that we get so worried when we're trying to communicate with that other species that we panic a little bit and we don't realize that we're actually not helping communicate the information to the dog. You know, it's like, I think dogs are a lot like 2 and 3 year old toddler human children, right? And so I always kind of keep that in the back of my mind, is my communication needs to be much clearer with a 2 year old than it does with my 22 year old, right? And so I try to come from that perspective. But I do find using no as a stop sign for yourself to say there's something happening here that you don't want to happen. Stop and figure out what you do want to happen and then train that thing.
Yes, very valuable information. So thank you for sharing. What about on the other hand, it's always lovely to hear highlights of life. You can share highlight with your own dogs, but also you can share some highlights from your customers.
Let's see. Well, you'd think I'd have some. I think for me, doing what I do, the biggest highlight is having a dog that is exhibiting behavior issues. Let's say, for example, leash reactivity. You know, they cannot walk their dog. You know, they can't go anywhere with their dog without their dog reacting to the presence of another dog or cars or whatever that particular dog has, you know, happens to react to. And I think it's so rewarding to be able to give people some tools to help them understand how the dog processes information, which is not always sometimes how we process it, but not always, right? And then to find that way to communicate with the dog that you don't need to worry so much about that, right? That you can move through the world without needing to push everything in your force field away from you, right? So I think that probably is, and you know, it's one after another of seeing dogs, whether they are clients' dogs that come from vet referrals or the shelter, where a dog comes into the shelter and you think, I'm not sure this dog is gonna, you know, has enough resilience. And then you watch everybody working with this dog, and that dog little by little just starts to blossom. Not that a shelter is a great place for a dog to be, but when you've been able to layer on some of that compassion and communication, then you've got a dog who is, you know, in a play group at the shelter with another dog, whereas before he wouldn't come out of the corner. You know, that reminds me, Buddy, my little Pekingese, my 16-year-old Pekingese, lived under the chair in my kitchen for the first 6 months, literally. He was little, so I could get him out from under the chair and get him outside to potty, but he was petrified of everything and everyone, the dogs, noises, everything. So he just lived under my kitchen chair. And I think that's, you know, that's one of the places that I think fall down. Sometimes we get impatient and we don't want to give dogs the space to learn at a pace that's acceptable to them. You know, 6 months after he was there, he came out one day and that was it. He was, you know, but we just gave him all that time. So I think that's super important. And for us too, you know, for me, the challenge, you know, I can't even believe I'm admitting this on a podcast, but for me, the challenge with competing in agility is I am so challenged in remembering 21 obstacles. I get to like 16 and I'm like, oh crap, where am I supposed to go? Where is 17? Does anyone know where 17 is? Right. And it mentally, it just so holds me back. You know, it's not my dog. I could give her to anybody and they could run her on any course and she'd be great. It's me. Right. So I think sometimes we have to just look and say, okay, you just take your time. It's not a rush. You know, we're just trying to find the best way for everybody to experience this, the handler as well as the dog. It doesn't do my dog any good if she's all loving it and running around and relaxed, and I'm like, oh my God, what happens next? Where did that go? Well, how am I going to get to that jump? So I think One Mind is just brilliant and breaking things down to a point where you can really have an understanding of the sport and the perspective of both the dog and the handler.
Right. That's so inspiring and hilarious. Poor your little dog.
Oh, yeah. Poor baby. happy now, though. 10 years later, he's happy.
I can assure that. Yeah, I'm. Yes. Well, you have already shared so many good insights for any dog owner out there. But however, I would like to also hear it from you. I always want to ask a couple of these same questions because we always get a little bit different perspective. But if any of your friends or your neighbor would be now getting their very first dog, it doesn't matter if it's a puppy or adult dog, but anyway, their first dog, and you should give them a couple of tips, a couple of simple tips that people can actually understand. So what would you tell them?
The first thing is, I'll think about it in terms of my kids when they get dogs, right? Don't be surprised when it seems harder than you thought it was going to be, right?
Right.
I remember doing a blog post a long time ago, and the title of the post was "Lower Your Expectations," right? I think that's where, you know, people have so much that they want to do with a new dog. They have an expectation of what adding that dog to their life is going to look like. And then they come up against reality, not anything bad, but it's just like, oh, wait, I thought, you know, I was going to be able to take the dog to the brewery after the first week, right? So I think just having patience with yourself. Generally, there are a couple of books that I give to, you know, friends who have gotten dogs or whatever. And I always give them a card that has that Bob Bailey quote on it of, you know, training often fails because people expect way too much of the dog and way too little of the handler, right? And I love that quote because I actually, every time I go to do a training session with my dogs, I will say that to myself, you know, just to remind myself, like, wait a minute, where we get into trouble is when it's all about our expectations. We expect too much of them, too little of us. So I think that's really important to just recognize that, yeah, there's going to be bumps, right? I mean, you know, any relationship that we have, whether it's a friendship, whether it's with our children, our parents, our spouses, our dogs, there's always bumps. You can't expect there to be no bumps with the dog. And I think that's sometimes where people get lost.
Exactly. I totally agree. And it's I also talk a lot about that, like the dream dog that people should describe. Yes. And then thinking of like, what's the path? But it's just reality that people don't many times have the understanding that what happens between the puppy time or like a adult dog with no experience of anything or learning even, and that like the journey from there to the dream dog is not quick. So no. it's typically very there are a lot of steps, and that's yes. Our mutual mission, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. I remember one of the funniest that I ever had. It was a way back, and I was teaching puppy class, and these two women had become friends. They were very different in age, but they had become friends. They had similar puppies and everything. And they walked into class one day and they're like, oh, and I was like, what's the matter? What's happening? I'm thinking there's going to be like a problem, right? And they're like, we are exhausted. I'm like, okay, well, the dog's not sleeping or something? And they're like, no, we're just trying to keep them entertained and do all this enrichment with them. I'm like, you know, they need to nap in there too. They're like, oh, yes, nap, just like babies, right? But again, it was an expectation thing. They really wanted to do the best for their puppy. They just kind of went to the other end and, you know, and thought it had to be a full-time 24/7 job, right? Like, no, that's not it either.
That's actually an excellent example, because I think that what COVID made or did was that when dogs then didn't have any time alone, then they actually lack of sleep quite a bit. So that's why they have also due to that fact, they have a lot of problems and behavioral issues.
Yes, absolutely. Yes. Changed a lot that COVID.
Not everyone is aware about them. How human societies and the rescue places work in the United States. And you are working for the Humane Society in Boston. And
right outside running your own, city, yep.
Yeah, and running still your own business at the same time related to the behavioral challenges. But it would be interesting, like super interesting to hear, if you can describe shortly how that human society and the rescue work, rescue organizations work in the United States, because I think it's new to many people who are listening to this are outside the US.
Right. So there are a lot of different models. You know, there are the big humane societies that tend to be open shelter. There are smaller ones that are more my size that we have a screening process. So that we, you know, you can't just walk in and drop off a dog like you can at some of the bigger shelters. We try to, again, set all the dogs up for success. If there are dogs that we can't help, we want to say that and be able to point them in a direction that is more appropriate. We do have a physical shelter, and we also have an incredible foster network. So that is, there are some dogs who just cannot handle. And our shelter, I think, is fabulous. We do a ton of enrichment. There's lots of training. There's, you know, but still, it's a shelter environment. It's not a home. So there are some dogs who just will do better in what is a foster home, which is somebody who agrees to take the dog in for a period of time or until the dog's adopted. And then there are other organizations in the US that are foster based only. And right now in the US, it's a really hard time. I've been in this part of dog welfare for about 15 years. I have never seen so many dogs in the Northeast being surrendered and so few adoptions as I have in the last 6 to 9 months. You know, we're lucky in the Northeast. We have a huge, and have had since like the 80s, spay neuter education. So we don't have lots of, you know, litters going on all over the place as some of the more southern states, where there's less spay neuter education. As far as people, you know, lots more dogs running loose and stuff like that. So it's tough right now. This is, again, to me, unprecedented in what I've seen in the last 15 years. So, you know, but every day you get up and you do the best you can and try to help as many as you can. And at the end of the day, that's all you can do.
Yeah, during the past 10 years, I have been like fortunate to be able to visit some and get to know this this work, and it's just incredible how much great work you guys are doing. So yeah. That's like from Europe perspective, I think many can't even imagine what it is, how it works, and how it is. I have also attended some conferences for that those organizations. It was really interesting as well. What type of dogs do enter them, and like why? What's your perspective of the main reasons?
Well, if I look at local surrenders, right, a lot of those, I think, and we're talking about this a lot right now because it's, again, so many dogs being surrendered. Some of it is behavior challenges. People who really just went out and got a dog. I'm going to get a dog because it's COVID, or, you know, COVID's over and now I want a dog. And really were not in a position to get a dog, wouldn't have been the best choice. And there were people who would just give a dog to anybody, right? Without, you know, rigorous screening or whatever. So I think that's coming back to bite a lot of people. You know, and there are a lot of rescues who won't take their dogs back. You know, a lot of that is like, well, no, we gave you the dog. That was it. So I think that's part of it. I think the fact that worldwide, we are in a horrific financial position with inflations, potential recessions. You know, I think people are really struggling financially. And, you know, the added expense of trying to care for another animal. And those are the heartbreaking, really heartbreaking, right? When, you know, you've got somebody who's can't pay their rent and, you know, is living in the car with their dog and they want the best for their dog. Those are the ones that are just, you know, really heart-wrenching. And, you know, just all the reasons that you would expect for dogs to be surrendered, we're moving, we can't take the dog with us. We have had a large number of international moves, you know, more than I've seen lately, where somebody's like, I'm moving to Japan and I cannot take this dog with me. Others are, you know, like divorce or a lot of more elderly people who are going into like an assisted living. Again, super sad because they've had the dog for like 8-10 years. And those are the ones that we really try to get into foster because those dogs have grown up in a home, right? They're 10 years old. You know, you want to put them someplace safe that it's already going to be hard enough. They're going to lose their person, right? So, you know, the reasons are just so myriad. But again, you do the best you can. And I will say, because I was at Crufts this year, I was so impressed with the rescue organizations that were at Crufts. There are some amazing rescue organizations, at least I think they were all from the UK, that there was one. And I was like, is this a husky rescue? She's like, no, there's just a lot of huskies, right? You know, so it was very interesting to kind of see the dogs that are in the UK that are ending up in the shelter, you know, are so different than the breeds that are here, right? But I really saw those rescue organizations over in the UK as just really doing a great job.
Yes, I agree. And I've also followed them closely recently. And I've noticed that the situation is similar in UK as it is in the US. However, I think it's a lot bigger and larger problem in the States, as it's also so large country.
Yes, right.
But hey, a little bit related to this topic, as with your experience, because you have this specific, unique background, and you can see from a little bit different perspective this whole situation with all the dogs and COVID and whatsoever. If there would be one thing that you could change in the world to make dogs' lives better, and for example, prevent this, these dogs losing their homes, what would that be? What would have the biggest impact?
I think, you know, if I'm going to just talk about it from a rescue perspective, as opposed to like being able to just go to a breeder and pick up a dog, right? You know, but it applies to everybody, is understand where you are in your life and take a minute to really, before you make this decision, you know. Again, from our rescue, the process is pretty onerous. You know, there are people who fall by the wayside because they're like, well, we don't want to work this hard, which is great because it's a sorting tool. Like if you can't get through the process, I'm pretty sure you're going to have a hard time taking care of a dog, right? But it's the same thing whether you're going to a breeder or not. Take a minute. Think about how this is going to affect your life. Recognize that if you're a person who, you know, is working 20 hours a day, you need to have a dog walker lined up, right? You know, you can't just expect the dog to fall in like it's a piece of furniture. So if I could change one thing, I think I would make everybody wait a 36 hours before making a decision. Just think about it and then make the decision, because there's a lot of buyer's remorse. Not that we're buying dogs, but you know what I mean? There's a lot of like, maybe this wasn't the right time for me to get a dog. I hear that a lot.
Well, that's a great point and very important. And yeah, I totally agree again. So yes. Typically when someone asks me about like recommendations for breeds or something, I'm saying like, hey, don't get a dog. And if they happen to ask me two or three times, again, then I can help them.
right. Exactly. Yes.
And I do this for everyone who is asking. So it doesn't matter what they have done before.
Yeah.
And then they're like, what? And then, yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. And then if they are like resilient enough, then they'll come back and then I'll help them.
Right. And then, exactly. Yep. Same exact thing. Exactly.
Yeah. Hey, now we are coming to the end of this lovely, super interesting episode. Beth, is there anything I didn't ask and you would like to share with us and the listeners?
I don't think so. I mean, I think just to reiterate, you know, I know this isn't about agility per se, this conversation, but I think when you're lucky enough to find something like One Mind Dogs that really does put the dog's perspective front and center, that's where you want to spend your time training. And that's what you should look for, whatever you're doing with your dog. If you don't get that same feeling of this person has my dog's best interest at heart, you need to immediately walk away and go find somebody else to work with, right? It's what I've done. I've walked out of classes before where I feel like, no, that's not serving my dog's best interest, right? I don't think my dog's happy here. At the bottom line is never be afraid to advocate for your dog. Don't be embarrassed. Don't be ashamed. You are your dog's advocate. They have no voice. You know, it's that saying of, you know, we have to speak for those who do not have a voice of their own. Right. So don't ever feel bad advocating. If your dog barks on leash and you're training, don't feel like you have to be embarrassed about that. you're doing the best you can, right? You are your dog's spokesperson.
Exactly. Hey, Beth, thank you so much for being our guest today and sharing
your
experiences and a lot of insight and super interesting story and background of yours.
Oh, it was a lot of fun.
Yes, indeed. And I would like to continue this for forever and ever.
Yes.
But I think it's for this, now we have to leave out some time for others as well. So thanks again, Beth, for joining
this. Thank you. Thank you very much.
To all our listeners, thank you for tuning in to the One Mind Dogs From the Dog's Perspective podcast. We hope you have gained inspiration for your own life with dogs and for learning more about the dog's perspective. Remember to follow One Mind Dogs on social media and sign up for the podcast newsletter to stay updated on our latest episodes and the exciting content. We would love to hear also from you, of course. So tag One Mind Dogs and share your special moments with your own dogs. See you in the next episode.